Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 8th, 2016. Investigators have returned their report from the January 26 shooting of Oregon standoff participant Lavoy Finicum.
She lied to the FBI when she told him she was innocent, a victimless crime. Now I don't give a shit and I never drop dime on my baby, though she gave it to the FBI. I lied to the FBI when I told him that I did it to save her heart.
Alkaline Trio opens our podcast today. Never heard of them, but I found this song, She Lied to the FBI, at Spotify. And we all know that it is a crime to tell a lie to the FBI. And the penalties were hardened in the Patriot Act. And Dennis Hastert, the former Republican Speaker of the House, got nailed by the law that he championed for lying to the FBI about those structured payments to the individual that he had sexually abused decades before. But what happens when the liar to the FBI or to other investigators is an FBI agent or a group of highly valued FBI agents involved in their vaunted hostage rescue team? Well, these are the findings that come from the investigation of that January 26 roadblock incident in Oregon. And the central findings have absolved the Oregon State Troopers. And I think that the evidence presented by the Deschutes County Sheriff and Prosecutor, who were brought in as outside eyes to investigate the incident, it does appear to me that the shooting was justified. The videos show that Finicum's truck was stopped before the roadblock, and he drove on in defiance of the orders to stop. And I'm going to save the details of that for a podcast that we're scheduled to record later today with Todd McFarlane, an attorney who has been representing the family of Lavoy Finicum, and Sibel Edmonds from Boiling Frogs Post and Newsbud. But this is a shocking sidebar story. That at the roadblock, as the forensic specialist looked at the gunshots that were pumped into Lavoy Finicum's truck, they found one that didn't match the others. It was a bullet hole that came at a different angle from those that were connected to the Oregon State Troopers on the scene there. And so the evidence led to an FBI agent who had twice denied to investigators that he ever even fired his gun. Well, it turns out he fired his gun not once but twice. And why did he lie to the investigators? I don't have a clue. But on the night of the shooting, detectives questioned the five FBI agents, and they questioned them again at least once. The hostage rescue team is among the FBI's most elite outfits. The members have no other job but to work full-time as a SWAT-style group operating from the FBI military base at Quantico, Virginia. One investigator working on the task force, and by the way, this is from excellent reporting in The Oregonian, and reporter Les Zaitz filed a number of stories shortly after this news conference that was held today, and I commend him on a fine job. Anyway, he says that one investigator reported that he had been told soon after the shooting that two state troopers and two FBI agents had fired. He said the FBI agents approached him later to say they hadn't fired their weapons. Now, I cannot summon any any theory or any hypothetical idea about why they would need to lie about that. The second time, the agents insisted that an attorney be present and they be given an opportunity to reference their prior statements so that they wouldn't get tripped up and lie to the FBI. Now, here's one other little clue that's buried in this comment from Deschutes County Sheriff Shane Nelson. Of particular concern to all of us is that the hostage rescue team operators did not disclose their shots to our investigators or their superiors, nor did they discuss specific actions they took after the shooting, which are the subject of an ongoing investigation. Now, authorities have not detailed what those specific actions were. But they may have destroyed evidence or tried to massage evidence. And what is so frustrating about this is that we know what happens from here. The FBI will investigate the FBI. And in 150 cases of 150 allegations of improper use of deadly force, the FBI has exonerated itself 150 times, 100%. So we know there will be a whitewash coming. We just don't know the exact dimensions of it and when it will be unveiled. But it just shows that the FBI is an agency that is out of control. And yet it continues to grab more and more power. The Guardian, London newspaper today, with a great reporter in New York, Spencer Ackerman, reporting exclusively that the FBI has quietly changed its privacy rules so it can access the NSA's raw data collected on Americans. Now we're told, don't worry, it's not every phone call. These are overseas phone calls that involve U.S. persons. A U.S. person may be an American citizen, could be just somebody who happens to be here in the United States. And this gets into the weeds of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You remember it was up for reform in 2008. Barack Obama said as a senator he would vote against it, particularly if it contained immunity for the phone companies. It did. He lied. He voted for it. And he has championed its abuse ever since. Now, the FISA law is coming up for renewal again later this year. And the odds that there'll be any meaningful reforms to protect our rights are near zil. Zil? Is zil a word? Zilch. I got caught between Zed and zilch. Sorry. So, the report that The Guardian is basing this on comes from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Group. And in 2014, it reported that the FBI was allowed direct access to the NSA's massive collections of international emails, texts, and phone calls. You know, the Bluffdale collection at that huge server farm in Utah. And at the time, concern was expressed that the FBI's minimization rules for removing or limiting sensitive data that could identify Americans wasn't occurring on those accessed NSA communications. So now it's official. The NSA will cough up anything the FBI wants. And it used to be we had a bright line, a firewall separating the domestic investigative powers of the FBI from the international spying powers of the NSA. But that's all over, and we're creeping toward police state here in the United States. And what's interesting is that this is viewed as a backdoor, not a software backdoor like they want Apple to install in the iPhone security, but a backdoor around warrants. And if you can allow the NSA and the FBI to share this information without restriction, then who needs a warrant? And, of course, we know that the Patriot Act allows these national security letters, which are self-executed warrants that an FBI agent doesn't even have to get approval from a judge for. And the other insidious part of this is that the FBI is allowed to nominate targets to the NSA. Again, an end run on warrants. There's another stain on the FBI's record that is about to be sealed up under a cover-up. And I do not for a moment defend James Whitey Bulger, the mob hitman who was convicted for a string of participating in 11 murders during the 70s and 80s. But Whitey Bulger was prevented from a robust defense in his trial. As you know, he had been on the lam. He was found in Santa Monica. I happened to be visiting a friend down the street the day that the FBI picked him up there, which was an odd coincidence. But the bottom line here is that Whitey Bulger was a paid FBI informant for many years. And he was not permitted to introduce into evidence his relationship with the FBI. And that included a claim that you might consider far-fetched, and I do a little bit. But he said that a former assistant U.S. attorney had given him immunity during the 1980s. And in return for protecting his life from the mobsters he prosecuted, he was allowed to kill other people. Now, that is extremely far-fetched, but the nature of his informant relationship with the FBI is something that should have been brought out at that trial. Today, I'm going to mostly take a pass on the presidential contests here in the United States. It is primary day. Michigan is where my focus is. We'll see what happens there. But the one story I feel is important today about the presidential campaigns is that Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire from New York, former mayor there who bought a third term by changing the local charter, he has decided he will not mount a third-party independent run for president this year. And he is wise to do so. He concluded that it would tip the election toward Trump. Now, the way I divide up the votes, I think that Bloomberg, as a fellow billionaire, would have siphoned votes off from Trump if he is the actual nominee. And if it's Ted Cruz, it's hard to know how the voters would fall, given three choices instead of two. But I think that the biggest practical issue was that Bloomberg concluded that he would not be able to get on the ballot in many states, and the biggest state with the biggest barrier to a third-party entrant this late in the cycle is the Empire State of New York. Meanwhile, the refugee crisis has reached a new critical stage in Europe and the war-torn areas of Syria that are producing so many refugees. And Turkey has taken advantage in the most cynical way of its role as the place that is a transit point for many of the refugees who are fleeing the war in Syria and some who are fleeing the conflicts in Iraq. And so this is a matter of extortion. From Turkey's point of view, it's an opportunity to squeeze the European Union for even more money. Now, to be fair to Turkey, they haven't collected the $3 billion that was promised earlier last year, to support refugee infrastructure. And the whole idea of the Europeans is they want to stop the flow at the source. They also want to force many Syrians to return from the places they have arrived in Europe, or even if they're just in Greece now, to a war-torn zone, and that's a clear violation of their human rights and UN standards. But Turkey, which has been cracking down on the Kurds as it pretends to fight the Islamic State alongside the United States, Turkey, which has recently been cracking down on media outlets, either shutting them down or converting them to state control, Turkey, which is a massive human rights violator of the Kurds, and has been for decades, well, the Europeans are politely looking away from the ugly aspects of Turkey, and they are responding to their demands for more money. And I don't know if you saw the Cheshire Cat smile of Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu. I'm not positive how to pronounce his name. Davutoğlu? I'm not sure. Anyway, he arrived in Brussels and, you know, just brushes off the human carnage that his nation imposes on a daily basis and was demanding the membership in the European Union that has been dangled over Turkey for some years now and more money. And this clearly is blackmail. It's extortion on the part of Turkey. And it really is barbaric at in what I would consider to be the lowest order of human behavior. And Selahattin Demirtas, the top Kurdish political leader, quoted as saying, "Blackmailing European countries in turn for the refugee crisis, this is something the European Union should not close their eyes to. The EU should see this as blackmailing, and this is not in line with European values." Well, I think that's pretty clear. Meanwhile, the American war machine just keeps chugging along. You may have seen the headlines now that the Pentagon claims that last Saturday, U.S. warplanes with a drone component struck a base in Somalia belonging to al-Shabaab. And the Pentagon claimed that we killed 150 fighters who were at a graduation ceremony ready to embark on a large-scale attack on forces belonging to the African Union in Somalia. But not so fast. Now, the U.S. is claiming this is one of the biggest, assaults in recent years. But Al-Shabaab contacted Al Jazeera, and the Al's got talking. And Abdulaziz Abu Musab, the military operations spokesman for Al-Shabaab, said, "The Americans are dreaming. We never gather that many of our fighters in one place. We know the security situation. Yeah, the attack happened, and it happened at the location they mentioned, but the number they are telling the world is a lie." I'll let you decide. Now, it's no lie that people support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast by generously taking out subscriptions. And I want to welcome Dominic Favuzzi from Santa Rosa, just up the road from me in California. He just took out a new annual subscription, and he emailed that he wants a copy of A Field Guide to the F Word. And Dominic, it's on the way right now. Thank you for your support of my work and your new annual subscription. You can do it too, along with people like Annette McManus, Benny Alto, Terry Paris. Take out a subscription, whatever you're comfortable with. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber, $5, $10, $20, $50 annual subscription. We've got the iPhone, iPad app that's available for you at the Apple App Store. If you are an Android user, Spreaker carries the Peter B. Collins Podcast and makes it easy for you to access every day on that smartphone of yours. So be generous. Step on up. I try not to be too demanding or, shaking you down. I don't want to be a Turkish extortionist, but I do need your support. And if you're a regular listener and you've got the cash to do it, come on through, will you? Well, the White House made an interesting announcement on Monday. Lisa Monaco, who is the counterterrorism and homeland security advisor, gave a speech promising to release full data, transparency, she said, on the victims of America's drone strikes since Obama took the White House in 2009. And they're promising to release not only the count of militants, as we call them, who have been killed, but also an accurate number of the innocents who have been killed along the way. And what's interesting is the coverage of the Monaco story reads this way. As Monaco spoke, the Pentagon confirmed it had conducted a massive airstrike in Somalia that left 150 people dead, one of the largest casualty totals in a military attack of the post-9/11 era, if the report is accurate. So Monaco is proclaiming, despite the fact that the Obama administration is in its final year, that this is going to be the first annual report on the status of American drone strikes and who they kill. And Corey Kreider, who is an outspoken attorney for Reprieve, says, well, this doesn't go nearly far enough. And she raises an important point. In every region where we pursued an aggressive secret drone policy, militancy has gotten stronger. It's not enough to tally up the drone's body count. We need a thorough reassessment of the program itself. And to that, I say amen. And while the administration has claimed that its drone strikes are very precise and that they go to great lengths, we saw the Michael Hayden piece out of his latest book that was excerpted in the Sunday New York Times two Sundays ago, where he was claiming, they wring their hands and they make sure that mom's not there when they pull the trigger on a Hellfire missile coming from a Raptor drone. But back in 2014, Reprieve did a study, and it found that to kill 41 militants, the U.S. killed an additional 1,147 people in Pakistan and Yemen. If that's any indication of the real body count from our drones, we've got lots of splaining to do. The Pentagon has leaked its plan to flatten the Islamic State in Libya. Through a calculated leak from anonymous sources to the New York Times, they have laid out what the military option is, even as the White House claims that it has not been green-lighted. And I think a lot of this is just machinations. Some of it's bureaucracy, some of it is trying to find the right time. But it's clear to me that the lame duck President Obama will launch this incursion into Libya sometime in the near future. British and French and Italians are pressuring the U.S. to take action. And just like the last time we got involved in an operation to invade Libya and take down Gaddafi, it's believed to be a cakewalk. No problem, man. You know, we got some commandos on the ground. They guide us to the targets. We blow them up. And poof, Daesh just disappears. Well, it's never that simple, never that easy. And at least in recent years, it never happens that quickly. A couple of quotes here from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing last week. First from Frederick Wary, a Libya expert at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. A great risk is that outside intervention against the Islamic State before a cohesive government is formed could exacerbate political conflicts, bolster the power of local militias, and throw the country into greater turmoil. But we're not going to listen to somebody like that. We've got an opportunity to play with our bombs, drop them and kill people. I mean, that's how we do it. Here's another dubious report that is prompted by the rules that Congress has imposed on the Obama administration to prevent the closure of the Guantanamo Bay prison. We have a new report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence about former prisoners who have so-called rejoined the fight or returned to the battlefield. But these claims are so bogus and exaggerated that it is just infuriating. So since Obama took office in January of 2009, there have been 144 detainees released. Of those, seven, according to the Pentagon, have been known to engage in post-release militancy. Now, that is a big jump because the report last year showed that six of the 144 had shown militancy. But the example that they serve up is that in December 15, Ibrahim Al-Kosi, a former cook and driver for bin Laden, who was returned to Sudan in 2012 after serving out a sentence imposed on him by a military commission, appeared in a propaganda video for Al-Qaeda's Yemen branch. Now, he appeared in a video. That's considered militancy? That's returning to the battlefield? And this is all supposed to make us cower in Des Moines or Phoenix or Huntsville, Alabama, and imagine that these guys who got out of Guantanamo are scheming to come to your house and do some dirty deeds. And it's pure fiction. And sure, a handful of those, have so-called returned to the battlefield. There are two who've been identified in Afghanistan, one on each side. And if you were locked up at Guantanamo for years without charge or trial, wouldn't you be pissed at the United States? Wouldn't you look for some way to express that? I think I would. As Vice President Joe Biden visits Israel, there has been a new wave of violence alleged committed by Palestinians against Israelis. In Jaffa, a 29-year-old American tourist was pronounced dead after a stabbing incident aimed at him and his wife. And the man accused of slicing him was shot and killed by Israeli law enforcement. And there were at least three attacks within a 20-minute period. Let me retract that. It was a 90-minute period, not a 20-minute period. And one was just a mile away from where Joe Biden was visiting the Paris Center for Peace. So this is sad to see. And, of course, it is a symptom of the simmering conflict that continues, the oppression of the Palestinians by the hardline government of Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu threw a hissy fit and has decided he will not come to Washington next week to pander to the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee. That, of course, is AIPAC. And he is throwing a tantrum because he claims he's not coming because he couldn't get a meeting with President Obama at the White House. And the White House had announced that they had agreed to meet with him on March 18th. And Netanyahu is going to address AIPAC by satellite. He said, you know, maybe I shouldn't come right now because you're in the middle of a presidential election. Now, that is so rich. Remember, it was just a year ago that Netanyahu came to Washington to campaign against Obama for his re-election in Israel. And he denounced the deal with Iran between the U.S. and five other countries. And he tried to scuttle that deal. And he tried to use members of our Congress and turn them against our own president. It was a remarkable, ugly scene driven by Netanyahu. And now he's saying that, well, he doesn't want to interfere in America's presidential election. Oberlin College in Ohio is a place that I visited as a young man when I lived in the Buckeye State. I always thought of it as this great bastion of liberalism. And right now, there's a witch hunt underway. As a professor who does not enjoy tenure, her name is Joy Correga, is facing charges that she has made public social media posts that are anti-Semitic and abhorrent. And I see this as the latest evidence of this concerted effort by Friends of Israel here in the United States to silence those who are critical of Israel and who promote boycott, divestment, and sanction on college campuses. And this is a huge intrusion into the First Amendment rights and the academic freedom rights of Joy Correga. Now, this resulted from an investigation by a Zionist media outlet called The Tower magazine. And they went to Oberlin and they conducted an investigation and they published some of the Facebook posts of Dr. Correga. And while you and I might not find them astounding, she challenges the notion that ISIS is a freestanding group. She basically claims it is a concoction of the CIA and Israel's Mossad. And I think she's well within her rights to make those statements. She has said that when Netanyahu went to Paris after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, uninvited, and of course he went even when he was asked by President Hollande of France not to come. That's true. And we know that that photo op that showed Netanyahu linking arms with other world leaders as they marched down a street, they made it look like it was a massive protest and that there were thousands of people behind them when there were maybe a couple of hundred. It was a staged photo event. At any rate, I support the free speech rights of Professor Correga, even in cases where I don't particularly agree with her comments. But here's one. She says, it's troubling in this day and age where there is still all this access to information. Most of the general public doesn't know who and what ISIS really is. I promise you, ISIS is not a jihadist Islamic terrorist organization. It's a CIA and Mossad operation, and there's too much information out here for the general public not to know this. Now, whether you believe that is accurate or not, is it anti-Semitic? Of course not. Even if you make completely false allegations about the state of Israel and about the role of its intelligence agency, Mossad, is that anti-Semitic? Of course not. And this is where the Israel effort, the Israeli-driven effort to silence opponents of the government of Israel and its leadership, they falsely construe that any criticism of Israel is therefore a hateful attack on people simply because they're Jewish. And this is insulting and infuriating at the same time. And far too many people buy it hook, line, and sinker. In recent days, I've provided a little coverage of the developing situation in Brazil, the Petrobras scandal. Last week, the surprise home invasion and detention of former President Lula da Silva. And our friend Pepe Escobar, who, of course, is involved in the NewsBud startup with me, Sabelle Edmonds, and many other people. He is from Brazil, and he spends very little time there because he is so conflicted. He considers it such a corrupt place that it's very hard for him to spend time in his native land. But he has been in Brazil recently and writing brilliant pieces for Sputnik and other outlets. And I'm going to link to his commentary and news article called The Brazilian Earthquake that was published on March 3rd, because it provides a lot of great background on the characters in this case and the scandal that is developing. He refers to the scandal as the car wash investigation. And this, of course, leads to the state oil company Petrobras, which was used as an ATM for political campaigns by members of some of the top political parties. Dilma Rousseff, the current president, is implicated indirectly. And Pepe does an excellent job laying this out in his inimitable style. I'm going to link to it so you can find it and read it for yourself, and I encourage you to do so. And in this same vein, I want to explain to you that this is the kind of reporting that NewsBud wants to bring to you on a regular basis. Pepe Escobar is, I think, one of the most impressive journalists in the world today. And I always learn from my conversations with him. His offshore view that's not tainted by the American media bubble is something that I consider to be extremely valuable. And so as I look at the screen right now, NewsBud has 1,334 contributors. It's inching up day by day. We're showing an amount pledged of $133,000 toward our goal of $950,000. So we need to kick it into overdrive or hyperdrive or something like that, because I really want to see us reach our goal and launch NewsBud later this year. And to be able to work with Pepe Escobar on a daily basis and bring you his wisdom, his vision, and his uncorrupted view, I think is extremely valuable. So come on over to newsbud.com, or you can go straight to kickstarter.com and just put NewsBud in the search projects window. And I encourage you to be as generous as you can. And if you've already donated, thank you. And if you're unable to donate, I understand. But maybe you can provide some clicks and share the information about NewsBud with friends and people who you think are likely to support this initiative to change the media in 2016. Thanks. I hope you will. And thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling underneath.